Hello and welcome to the Just Interesting podcast, the podcast that's not as exciting as Nemesis Inferno at Thorpe Park in Surrey, but more exciting than the two-hour queue line for Nemesis Inferno at Thorpe Park in Surrey.
That is
with
amazing.
Me today, wow. Robin.
Hello. That was an incredible introduction, doing? Martin. That was just fantastic.
Well, thank you. I was trying to think, like, we said, okay, let's record.
Yeah.
Hit record, and I was like, what am I going to say? So I just thought, Thorpe Park. That came to mind.
I mean, so
we'll roll with it.
I think even by British standards, that's a fairly niche reference to a specific ride. So
it's
then?
A theme park.
Yeah.
Just for those American listeners out there, viewers who may not know. So there we go.
How could they not know? It's the one and only Nemesis Inferno. Did I miss something? Are we now sponsored by Thorpe Park?
Thorpe Park, yes,
sponsored
we are.
Sponsored by Thorpe Park, and specifically the Nemesis Inferno ride. fun fact, the original Nemesis is at Alton Towers, isn't it?
Really?
Yeah. There we go. Anyway, how are you, Robin?
I'm fine, thank you. Happy to be here, yeah. It's
good.
It feels like ages since we had a podcast, so yeah. This week has been a long week, so it's nice to be back.
Yeah.
How are you both doing?
I'm not bad. Yeah,
I'd second that, Robin. It definitely feels like it's been too long. I mean, it hasn't. It's been basically the same amount of time. A few days longer, I think. But yeah, no, it's nice to hear. Nice to hear your lovely voices.
Oh, thank you.
Good. Are you okay, Alex? You've had a good one. Good week. It's been all right.
Yeah, I'm all right. I've been kicked out of our lounge and. I'm in the guest room.
Why?
Guest
what's room. Happened?
It's just the bedroom.
yes, the guest room. If you were the guest.
Well, welcome to my studio flat. I mean, this is the guest bedroom, also my bedroom, and the kitchen and the bathroom.
The ensuite's down the hall, so it's just the bathroom. Yes.
You know, I wanted to make it seem bigger than it is.
Like the TARDIS, but you're on the inside.
Is that a common occurrence?
Can we stop the podcast and should we just cut this and do that all again?
Oh my goodness!
No, the show must go on. The show must go on.
To answer your question, Martin, yes, I'm fine. Thank you.
That's funny. That's one of the most messiest starts we've ever had. But this week,
do you want to talk about the weather?
Yeah, that's traditional, isn't it? That's the traditional opening to the podcast, the weather instead.
Oh, we did so well to avoid it this time. Oh.
Let's skip it.
It's been fine.
It's not worth it. It's not worth it. Yeah.
A little bit of light rain, that's about it. But anyway, this week we're going to be discussing what we've learned, which should be good, because a brief conversation with you guys. It seems pretty interesting, quite varied this week. Mm. And then our main topic is going to be about disinformation during the UK election in particular, but disinformation in general, but specifically we're going to look at the UK election and how the parties here have been using this, particularly social media, to misinform and to twist words and, quite frankly, just to lie in order to try and win the election. So we're going to discuss that too. And then we're going to finish off with a quiz.
Yay.
So, quiz, general knowledge. And the first three questions I think you guys might enjoy, so... And the rest of it you'll hate. But anyway, the first three questions you might enjoy.
That's interesting.
So seven questions on rugby union. And
Exactly. And then the first three are on Dick Turpin and the and Orson Welles. Yeah.
Nice.
So what have you guys learned this week? Alex, let's start with you. Because I feel like I quite often start with Robin. So Alex, what have you learned this week?
I mean, it's much appreciated. Thank you. So I learned something interesting this week. Have you, either of you, heard of a fella called Whipping Tom?
No.
Never heard of Whipping Tom?
Afraid not. Afraid
Did
I can't.
He make can't cream to go on top of hot chocolate?
That's a good Whipping guess, Tom. But no, he did not.
He's not part of the BDSM community?
Well, that's more along the right lines, but
really?
Not quite.
Oh.
This is... some say he's the precursor to old Jack the Ripper, Whipping Tom. No one says that actually. He's nothing like Jack the Ripper. But he's got a cool nickname like Jack the Ripper, Whipping Tom. But he was active around 1681 in the small courtyards between Fleet Street, the Strand, and Holborn in London. He would wait in the narrow and dimly lit alleys and courtyards, and then he would approach unaccompanied women. He would grab them, lift their dresses, and slap their buttocks repeatedly before fleeing. Oh, whipping Tom. So he would go around spanking women, basically. And he would sometimes accompany his attacks by shouting, "Spanko!" He would actually do that. And he apparently attacked a large number of women, sometimes with his bare hands, sometimes using a rod of some kind.
Ooh, wow.
And he would carry out his attacks and vanish with such speed that some people attributed him with having supernatural powers.
I see.
Yeah. It takes some skill to pull off attacks like that and get away with it.
How can that be your take from this, Robin?
I'm not respecting him. I'm just saying, so skilled. I can understand. That's a very specific, I'm going to assume, fetish going on here.
You'd imagine so, wouldn't you?
Yeah. I don't know. Alex, you left me speechless, to be honest. That's an incredible story. And I feel sorry for all his victims. But also, what leads you to do that? What leads you to one day decide you're going to lie in wait, lift up a woman's skirt after she walks by, and just spank her bum? And then run away?
There's a lot of unanswered questions, so let me try and fill in some blanks for you. So this incident caused a great public outcry from the citizens, who then complained about the ineffectiveness of London's policing arrangements. So just this one rogue person going around slapping bottoms caused everyone to question the effectiveness of the police force.
That was public indecency.
It even prompted male vigilantes to dress up as women, to try and lure him in, and patrol the areas that he was known to operate in.
And, Monty Python.
Yeah, interesting.
I know, right?
They didn't do that for Jack the Ripper. It's almost as if they were a lot braver when it came to just whipping.
Yeah.
Well, people in 1681 didn't mess around. Now, eventually, a haberdasher from Holborn and an accomplice were captured in late 1681.
There were two of them.
They were tried for the attacks.
Hold the buttocks while the other one slapped?
I think maybe one was a lookout or something, but unfortunately, no records exist of their trial or their identities.
What?
Which is sad. So sad to see.
It's still a mystery. Yeah.
And there's one twist in this tale. This is not the only whipping Tom. There was another whipping Tom of 1712.
A copycat.
Maybe he was the same one.
We've got a copycat. 40 years later, yeah.
And this was 30, near Hackney. Another person also named Whipping Tom would approach lone women and beat them with a great rod of birch. So it seems less like it doesn't specify whether it was whether you'd be spanking them on the bum. Seems a bit harsher.
Definitely, doesn't it? Yeah. And you said that the other one used like an instrument or a metal pole
a rod,
or whatever.
Yeah.
Modus operandi. Yeah.
Yeah.
Again, and like the fact that there were two of them is just why? What does the lookout get out? Why? Yeah. What's he doing?
Just a perv, mate. Absolute perv.
But like a really weird perv. I can get perversion.
Careful here.
I've got to be careful. Like, if they're a peeping Tom.
That's the wrong moment to start.
That was the wrong moment to phrase. Yeah, phrasing.
Someone cut that. That'll be my buzzer next week.
God, no.
I take
perversion.
I'm taking that buzzer.
That's the terrible
I get
one.
Perversion.
Oh, no. It's finally happened. Oh, well.
We've all said it now, so use whichever one you like.
I've said it, so I'll continue. I can begin to understand perversions such as S&M and peeping Toms, things like that. But being the accomplice to somebody else spanking random people in the street and running away, I don't understand what you get out of that. That makes no sense to me. I don't understand why you'd want to whip random people on the bum anyway, but why you'd want to be the accomplice who just watches them whip other people on the bum, I don't get.
Thing is, Robin, okay, there was far less entertainment back in 1681.
That's true.
So, I mean, yeah, you know.
Next time someone complains about video games being too violent, tell them what happened when video games weren't around.
Exactly.
You want You're another whipping Tom on the streets. Yeah. Exactly. Let so this was be there a warning.
Was there as much outrage to this latter whipping Tom, or was he just like, everyone like, oh, we're bored of the whipping by now?
Well, he was caught. So there was a local man named Thomas Wallace was captured and confessed to the attacks.
Oh, his name was actually Tom.
Yeah, well, I don't know if the first person was retroactively called Whipping Tom, maybe. Okay. Or, I'm not sure, to be honest. But according to him, he resolved to be revenged on all the women he could come at after that manner for the sake of one perjured female who had been barbarously forced to him. So sounds like he was like, he had been betrayed by someone, by a female. And Vought swore to take it out on all womankind.
Okay. So he's also just a chauvinist, sexist, general. Yeah,
exactly. And he planned to attack 100 women before Christmas, cease the attacks during the 12 days of Christmas, and then resume the attacks in the new year.
Oh, oh my goodness.
Because, you know, not over Christmas.
He's not a complete nutter, is he? I mean, you know, he's not a monster. Take Christmas off.
Yeah, give them a reprieve. You've got to
have a break. Man. Have a break from time to time, haven't you?
Man.
Well, thank you, Alex. That was slightly disturbing and went to some new lows, some new depths. So thank you.
Thank you. That was really interesting.
Robin, what have you got for us this lovely week?
It's not as fascinating as Whipping Tom, but it is a mystery, so it's kind of connected in that sense. And this is news from the last week. In New York State, on a farm in the town of Barr, I think, a locked safe appeared in the middle of a field. And it weighs between 500 and 600 pounds. And there was a note attached to it that said, if you can open this, you can have what's inside. And a crowd gathered, and they tried to open it with a sledgehammer. They failed. And now the police came and broke up the crowd, and the farmer has currently hidden the safe and isn't opening it, and says he'd prefer to leave it a mystery.
Oh.
Yeah.
So what did he put in there? I'm voting. I reckon it's Gwyneth Paltrow's.
The farmer did it. Yeah,
at least it's not that perfume or whatever we discussed a few weeks back.
All right. It's the latest goop. Yeah, publicity stunts. I don't know. I feel like it's not a good thing. I feel like anyone who leaves a random safe on a farm with a note saying "Open it, go on, it's fine," is probably put anthrax in there or something.
Yeah.
Unless, who knows? Maybe it's declassified or previously classified files from the government. Somebody's found the safe with the JFK files locked in, and it's like, aha, found it. And then they just left it on a farm. Who knows?
So did the safe belong to the farmer?
No, it just woke up one morning, there's a safe there with a note saying, whatever's inside, you can open this safe, you can have it.
Oh, he's definitely just waiting for people to forget about it, and then he's going to crack it open,
It could even be a targeted attack on the farmer. He knows that he's the most likely person to be there opening it.
Could be. Hmm. Yeah, actually, did the farmer find it or did someone find it? Because I imagine maybe someone really wanted this to go, you know, get a lot of attention. Like, because there have been several safes online that have been like mystery safes and that kind of thing. Like, they've been quite popular.
Is that a thing? I didn't know.
Yeah, they've been quite popular on Reddit. Like, people find safes and then post them and then they kind of
so it could be
blow
something
up
like
in
that.
Popularity.
Yeah.
But I think maybe if he left it in the middle of the field, I think the first person who found that is probably like a key suspect.
Maybe.
Do you know what I mean? Because maybe they put it there and they had to go and find it because no one else found it.
Yeah.
Yeah, a bit like when someone finds a body, they're often spoken to, aren't they? Quite extensively. Yeah. Because, let's be honest,
it's suspicious. Yeah.
One of the easiest covers would be, I found it. Why are your fingerprints here? Well, I found the body.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm.
Well, in fairness to the farmer, he might not have anything sinister planned, because he said that he'd like to keep it a mystery, because in these times with the virus and the politics, it gives people a chance to set their problems or troubles aside and have a lot of fun talking about it. And apparently there's a local history museum that's planned to open in the near future, and the safe could eventually become part of that, is one possibility. So, yeah. But do you think it's just some kind of stunt? Or do you think it's the latest Cicada 3301? Is that what it is?
3301
is the right number, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I haven't heard any musings from Cicada 3301. Would they start up again by leaving a safe in a field? I feel like they'd put something online first.
Is it very Cicada? Probably. Yeah, that's the thing. Yeah.
Not particularly, I suppose.
I like the idea of it being like a wild goose chase, you know. Mm, maybe even offline, like a treasure hunt, but on the inside of the safe is just coordinates to somewhere else. And it's like a long treasure trail.
Yeah.
That'd be cool.
Actually, inside the safe is 50-year-old Indiana Jones, who's like, I got in here to survive an explosion in Nevada. How did I end up in New York?
Yeah. What would he be surviving off? What would he have in Indiana Jones?
Like, pure manliness. Just testosterone keeping him alive all this time.
I've been surviving off sweat. And my beard. I've been eating my beard. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I wonder whether the truth will come out about that. Maybe not.
I bet it's one of those stories that will never be followed up on by the news. So I'll never know.
Probably not.
But anyone who lives in New York and knows about this story, please keep us updated.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I'm interested. Absolutely. I reckon the farmer, if he didn't put it there himself, is going to have a go at opening it.
Oh, yeah. At some point, the curiosity will get the better of him.
And then they'll find him
hack into it.
Disintegrated by the Egyptian booby trap inside the safe.
Oh, yes.
You released the mummy's spirit, you fool.
Exactly, yeah. Not a good idea. Yeah. We've learned that from many a film. Do not open the safe. Yep. And we've learned that from the Bible, haven't we? With a few weeks ago, with the Ark of the Covenant.
Oh,
do
yes.
Do not open that either. Yeah. There, it's the Ark of the Covenant. Yeah. There we go. New York Upstate.
There you go. What did you learn this week, Martin?
This week, I learned about the huge logistics of the elections taking place in India.
Oh, yeah.
So they took place last year, but an article that I've found recently just shows how crazy it is for this thing to happen. So in India, we know that it's the land of well over a billion people.
Yeah.
And 900 million of these are eligible to vote.
Wow.
And also voter turnout is quite high at around 65%. So, a lot of people are voting in India. I mean, relative to other countries, that's fairly high. Mm. So basically they have it mandated in India that the maximum distance that you can be from a polling station is 2 kilometres. Okay? So if you're a civilian, you've got to have a polling station within 2 kilometres of you. Now, in the UK, that seems quite reasonable, doesn't it? Like, we go to our local polling station, it's usually down the end of the road, or at the very most, a short walk away.
And we're a pretty geographically small country as well.
Exactly. Whereas India has some pretty remote areas, and this causes these issues.
Yeah.
So, in effect, what it means is that they have to get some of these big electronic voting booths, to within 2 kilometres of every single person in the country. So the government employs 11 million civil servants to carry out this role.
Wow.
Getting these electronic voting counters to everyone in the country. These machines, yeah. Because they don't believe that that if they just employed people outside of the government, that it would be like legitimate. They would have issues over fraud and over people kind of rigging, which... I don't necessarily know that you can have 11 million people and know that they're all independent.
Yeah.
But hey, I'm sure there is some fraud going on there, but that's the reason they do it. So yes, they hire all of these civil servants to carry out this role.
Yeah.
And they have to travel all across the country and deliver 2.3 million of these electronic voting machines to some of the remotest parts of India, which is crazy. It's mental. And they have to get there via boat and sometimes via elephant, and they have to go over mountains, and it's an absolute shit show basically to get everyone to vote. And there are some amazing pictures which I'll include here of people carrying these electronic voting machines up over steep hills.
Oh really?
So yeah, it's just an absolutely crazy situation going on in India when it comes to voting time. So yeah, that's what I wanted to just to bring in.
That's
because
incredible.
I thought that was just mad.
That is amazing.
Because I mean, the population of England is 55 million, isn't it? I think of the UK, it's
about that,
approaching
isn't it? Yeah.
70 million. So 11 million people. As a percentage, I guess that's a drop in the ocean of India, because they've got over a billion now.
It was like 1.3 or something.
Something like that, yeah. But still, 11 million people riding elephants and crossing rivers and going up into the mountains. That's incredible.
Yeah.
That's insane.
But well done them for taking on the task of trying to deliver democracy.
It does make you wonder, is in the future, will there be an easier way to vote? Can you just vote online, vote on your phone or something? I know not everyone will have a phone. But
India has some like really abject poverty, doesn't it? There must be places that don't have access to the internet.
The infrastructure is just not there. Yeah. And I guess it probably goes hand in hand that the places that are the remotest are also the places that are the poorest and don't have that infrastructure. So they need people to go out there. But yeah, absolutely insane task in India every time there's an election.
I wonder if they can make... this is a pointless question because it's so debatable in any country. But I was just thinking about those people who are so cut off. Can they make any kind of really informed political decision when it comes to making a vote, placing a vote? but that's not the point. The point is that they should have the right to vote and the access to voting, and that's important. And there's nothing to say that a poor person in a remote village in a mountain in India is any less informed politically than an incel on in the heart of London in the UK.
Yes. Yeah. Maybe they should maybe at the polling place they should just lay out the candidates and their like key policies just like on each voting slip or something.
Yeah.
Just like he's gonna do this, and this, and he's gonna do this, and this. So if they don't even know who's who, they can at least base it on something.
I mean, should we all do that, right?
I think that's not a bad idea. Yeah, having like the key policies listed on the actual voting form. That might. I bet there's probably some law against that to prevent.
I imagine so. Yeah. I imagine you couldn't know.
There's no way of. There might not be any way of doing it without some inherent bias or people making some outlandish promises on the. On the voting card that they could never ever do.
Trying to boil down your policies into 10 words that will fit underneath your name on a voting sheet is probably pretty impossible.
Very true. But it's mad. I imagine that a lot of these places are incredibly partisan. They vote on cultural and religious lines if you're in a really remote area, I imagine.
That sounds likely.
Be interesting to know. That's I'm hazarding a guess there. I don't know for sure. Okay, let's have a look at some of this week's or last week's. This last week's best comments on the channel. Do you have any good ones, guys?
Well, I'll get my one out of the way just because it's a simple question from Viv Bluster, who asked, question, does it make a difference to you which platform we watch/listen on? I don't know about you guys, but personally, whichever one you prefer.
It's at your convenience. You're the consumer, so please do what's ever best for you.
I think the most helpful thing for us is to keep commenting, keep letting us know what you think and on whatever platform you choose.
I mean, if you are listening on your podcast platform of your choice, do give us a review on Apple. I think is the main one that does the reviews and it does help us out. So if you are listening right now, just if you could take a second, that'd be amazing. We've actually had one this week. Which I'll get up in a minute. You guys do your comments first because I need to still find it. But give us a review and interact. That's the main thing.
Yeah, I mean, I just want to respond to that comment with, I've heard some things lately on YouTube. There have been other podcasters talking about certain platforms being better for them, like Spotify or Apple Podcasts. I don't know.
Are you talking about a Super Show podcast?
They may be one of the ones I'm talking about. I don't know why they say that. I'm not privy to any kind of information that suggests any particular platform is more helpful to us than any others. So there might be something I'm missing, but please listen to on whatever platform you want to listen to. And I think we're on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Castbox.
Yeah.
Deezer.
We're on Castbox. What?
Yeah.
Of course we are. We're worldwide, mate. Yeah. Worldwide.
And then I think radio.com, Radio Public, and Audio Boom, I believe, are the ones we're on. We could be on some others.
Take your pick out of all of those.
Yeah.
Take your pick. And no, we don't care.
And of course, we're on YouTube. You may be watching us now on YouTube. I've got a comment on YouTube. On our last podcast, which was about criminals who got away with it. And it's from Kuko Pert, the skater boy. And it was about one of the things that we discussed in the This Week I Learned segment about John Wayne Bobbitt, who had his penis cut off. Sounds like I went into a barber shop and was just like, could you please cut off my penis? No.
What would you like? I'd just have a hair wash and a penis cut off, please.
Oh, dear.
Do you want your haircut? No, just
my penis, please. No, his wife cut his penis off whilst he slept after he had abused her for several years. So he probably deserved it. We mentioned the fact that he got his penis reattached and then made a couple of porno movies. And Kuko Pert, the skater boy, rather informatively says, Ron Jeremy, the porn star, met and pitched the idea for a porno to John Bobbitt. And John Wayne Bobbitt Uncut is on Pornhub if anyone is interested.
No, Uncut.
Uncut.
That's a good one. Oh. Sadly, though, I can't find Frank and Penis.
Is that you saying that or him?
That's him saying that. This is Kuko Pert, the skater boy. In my defense, I didn't realize those were the titles. So classic porn, just witty titles right there. But also,
very good.
I'm not going to ask how you know that. So thanks, Kuko Pert, the skater boy.
And we'll leave that there. I said that we had a review from 50DW50. So I don't know your name, but thank you very much. And he gives a 5-star review and just says, excellent, loving the new podcast. Hey. I mean, we're 27 episodes in, but it's still relatively new, isn't it? It's this year.
Yeah.
So thank you. It's very kind.
Very close to matching halfway of our previous podcast duration.
Yeah,
definitely.
Good point.
It's mad that it's gone on for the. We've had this is the 28th episode. This one, I think, absolutely insane. That's all I had to say about that.
Absolutely mad. He was done. And with that, he was done. We also got another comment from Joseph Stolzberg, and Joseph says, clearly Robin was miscalibrated during his last service update. He keeps on saying things that are far too interesting. Hashtag robot.
Oh, the hashtag still there. Yeah.
Still there. It comes through once in a while.
Well, Alex started that. Well done.
Thanks. I think you've adequately paid me back for that now, Robin, the whole Dick Turpin thing.
I'm sorry I was too interesting last week. I'll try to be more boring in future.
Yeah. Nemesis Inferno Q lines.
Good.
Think slightly better than Nemesis Inferno. Q lines, that is, not the ride, which is exceptional. I think this is probably about the right time to say that we've recorded a video for Patreon this week, haven't we?
We have indeed.
We have. And it's not just about a Chinese restaurant.
No, it's not. It's the ever-growing and never-ending, it seems, saga of Kim Jong-un being dead once again. He's dead.
He's gone again.
Fourth time this year, is that?
I lost count.
Fifth time this year?
Many times.
Yeah, he's dead again. So that's available for patrons for our bronze tier. We've changed the tiers, so now the bronze, silver, gold, you know. Gamification, this is 101. So if you do want to go over there for bronze tier and up, you can get access to that, where we discuss Kim Jong-un and him being dead or maybe not being dead, or perhaps being in a comatose state, or perhaps a shift of power. So, all of the above.
Let's not rule anything out here.
Exactly.
He's dead and in a coma. What?
Doesn't make sense.
Is that even possible?
Doesn't need to make sense.
Whatever sells newspapers.
Yeah, exactly. So with that said and done, shall we move on to the main topic of the week?
Mm.
And this week's topic is disinformation winning elections? So I thought we'd bring this one up because a recent article came out in The Independent, the UK paper The Independent, saying that the Conservative Party in particular, not all parties in the UK, but the Conservative Party in particular, used disinformation with a new level of impunity during the 2019 election. I think the first thing to bring up is the difference between disinformation and misinformation. So misinformation is basically when you say something that isn't true, basically by accident, whereas disinformation, put it simply, is basically lying on purpose, providing people with the wrong information. So this particular article follows the study of researchers from King's College London, who warn that the campaign that the Conservatives undertook during the election risked undermining public trust during the coronavirus pandemic. The reason being that if it comes, well, as it's come out that a lot of disinformation was published in terms of the response to the pandemic, people are less likely to trust what the government is saying now, and that of course causes major issues when it comes to public health. So this particular report, of course we can't say whether a particular report, the people who've studied this have a particular political affiliation, you know, you've got to bear these kind of things in mind, but their report concluded that the Tories, the Conservative Party, had employed overt disinformation to secure votes. And they have a few examples of this, and one of the primary ones being that they've altered videos of Labour leaders, and recently of Keir Starmer, the Labour leader, to make him basically look stupid and using like Comic Sans font and all this kind of stuff.
I remember that.
Yeah. Mm, do you remember that one showing up? And most of these things are very much on Facebook, aren't they? Facebook and other social media platforms, where they're targeting very, very specific groups of people, in order to cause this disinformation. And one of the ones that I remember coming out at the time was the Conservative Twitter account. Do you remember there was a debate, wasn't there?
Yes.
And they changed their Twitter account to Fact Check UK, I think it was, or something like that.
Yeah.
Where they changed the party account to being a fact-checking device, just commenting on everything that was happening during the debate and saying basically their spin on it, but calling it fact, which is one of the most, I don't know, just so overtly underhand tactics, wasn't it? It was so overt.
Yeah. And they were called out on it almost immediately within a couple of hours and the next day, but the damage had been done. They had pretended to be a fact-checking Twitter feed, basically claiming everything the Tories said was true and everything the opposition party said was misleading or false, when actually the reverse was true, and the Tory leader in the debate was the most misleading, according to real fact-checkers.
Yeah. But what was like, what felt really different this time around was how, like, if someone was caught doing that in previous elections, I feel like they would have come out the next day and apologized, or like someone would have resigned, or something dramatic would have happened, but people would have been held in some way accountable, and you would have felt like there was some kind of closure from it. Whereas the next day after that, what's his name? Dominic Raab and Michael Gove just kind of went on TV and defended it. It was bizarre. They were saying like, oh, we were just providing, you know, a fact checking for what was going on. And they're just completely ignoring the very obvious fact that they're being disingenuous and have hiding behind facts when clearly they're a biased source.
Yes. I mean, I've said this a few times, I think, in the last few months on this podcast, but no one resigns anymore for things they do wrong. It seems like there's a moral vacuum in regards to people lie, and they cheat the public, and they steal from the public, and it seems now that, oh, because my colleagues haven't resigned in the past, no one resigns anymore, you know, we can just get away with it. And it seems like this mass of what you can only describe of bullshit is just shoved down our throats so often that we almost become fatigued to this lying, to this cheating. Yeah. And so people feel like it's not as a... Yeah, it's just that they don't have to not only resign, but just not even apologise for blatantly lying to the public.
I think that's... Sorry, Martin, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, carry on, carry on.
So that seems to be like the major conclusion of this new report that's just come out, which is saying that this kind of disinformation, outright lying essentially, has become normalised in the last few years. And a large part of that is because of social media, but a large part of that, at least in British politics, is because of Donald Trump. Because of his success in 2016 using disinformation to win votes. And clearly, it's very clear that the Tory party, at least in this country, if not our other parties as well, have looked at that success and thought, hey, well, if that worked, why not try it over here?
A blueprint, right?
Yeah. And I think it's important to say, I imagine there's some people probably thinking like, oh, you're only telling one side of the story, you know, that everyone does it, all politicians are the same. But I think there was an independent survey done during the election. So this was a BBC headline during the election campaign, where it said, ads are indecent, dishonest and truthful, was the headline. And then, so this was based on a non-partisan body of advertising professionals had gone through and analysed all the social media adverts that each political party was putting out. And they found that the Conservative Party, 88% of the party's most widely promoted ads featured claims that had been flagged by independent fact-checking organisations as not correct or not entirely correct.
That's ridiculous.
Labour, on the other hand, at first they couldn't find any misleading claims, but then after further analysis, they found that 7% of their adverts contained inaccurate or misleading claims. So before people say like, oh, it's the same, you know, for both of them, there's a difference between 90% and like 5 to 10%.
That is disgusting. Yeah, that's absolutely disgusting.
It's not the same on both sides. It's clearly one side does it more than the other.
I guess the follow-up question to that is actually how much impact does this have on politics? Could this be the thing that actually sways an election? And I think that you can't say for sure, can you? You really can't, because you know what someone's seen on a Facebook ad is very difficult to quantify, whether it changed their mind or what adverts they were served. You know, it's very difficult to do unless you're going on a very molecular level on each individual person and their voting habits. So that's probably why it's such an effective tactic, because you can't necessarily trace it back to actually having an impact on the election or on people's voting patterns.
Yeah, you're right. And they keep saying that. All the experts keep saying that. Whenever it's mentioned that there's lots of disinformation being used by political campaigns, even the experts are saying, we don't know if it's actually had an effect. And a big part of that is because I think the research just hasn't been done yet. But it's important to note that there has been some information in terms of trying to gauge the potential scale of the problem. And I think, firstly, my personal opinion is, look at, like Alex just said, the scale of the disinformation being used by parties and by candidates in the West at the very least, and look at who the winners are. In the 2019 election in the UK, we had a landslide majority victory for the Tory party. In the US, it wasn't a landslide. Obviously, Trump lost the popular vote, but he very decisively won the Electoral College and won the presidency. And there was some research carried out, going back to what you're saying, that most of this disinformation is being carried out on social media. And according to the latest surveys, I think something like 55% of US adults get their news from social media. So that's over half the population, the voting population, sorry, in the US, and probably similar statistic over here in the UK, and the West in general, I imagine, get their news from social media. So as soon as that's established, you've got over half of the voting population are vulnerable to disinformation on social media. And then there was a study carried out in the wake of the 2016 election in America, where they surveyed voters and they confronted them with 6 demonstrably false headlines that had been used. And I don't know if they were used in favor of Trump or not, but they were six definitely disprovable false headlines, and they asked voters first if they were familiar with the headlines and secondly whether they thought they were true or not. And 75% of people who were familiar with the headlines before the election believed that they were accurate.
Yes.
So that's just a small sample, but it suggests, I think, that this kind of tactic is having an effect on politics. And of course, politics isn't just about whether you think it's better to be socialist or capitalist. It's about electing people who are going to guide a country through crises like a pandemic. And as this report, Martin said at the beginning of this this segment of the podcast, raises the question of, can you trust a government about anything when their entire success, their foundation, is based on lies? And it's always, it's the boy who cried wolf scenario, which we mentioned in our Patreon. You know, you lie all the time, and then you expect people to trust you and to do what you say. And normally, in a peaceful democracy, you might think that's not a problem, because a day-to-day life doesn't involve big lies, it just involves surviving. But when you have a pandemic or a war, when people are literally dying, and when people's livelihoods, because of the economic impact of those wars or pandemics, are under threat, people's behaviours are going to be determined by whether or not they trust the government's instructions. And that goes both ways. Either you believe the lies of the government, and therefore you might act foolishly because the government can't necessarily be acting in your best interest, or when the government is acting in your best interest, you're inclined not to believe them and therefore do something reckless and foolish. And it would be interesting to know if that's had an effect here in this country, with the number of controversial instances of people gathering in large numbers despite the pandemic guidelines.
I think I think as well, people don't like to believe that they've been lied to or that they've been tricked. And it kind of forces people to either abandon what they voted for and admit that they made a mistake, or, and I think in the most likely most cases, double down and really kind of, you know, just kind of ignore everything to the contrary that that disputes what you've your worldview and your belief system has been based on.
Yeah, there have been numerous studies. One of the major, the best examples of this is climate change denial, where not only has there been disinformation put out there to make people believe that climate change, or rather mankind's contribution to climate change, it doesn't exist, but the psychological impact of people who have succumbed to that disinformation and then been presented with, and are presented and continue to be presented with, very strong, compelling scientific evidence that mankind is having an effect on the climate, and it's not a good one, and yet they become more entrenched in their denial of climate change because they don't like to admit they were wrong. And that's, I think, I can't remember who it was, but there was a famous psychologist, you know, of, I think, of the Freud and Jung generation, who first established that humans don't like to be wrong. And time again, psychological studies have proven that people don't like to admit that they've made a mistake and don't like to change, basically. They don't like to reverse their position on anything. It's like a bit like the sunken cost fallacy, that whole, like, oh, I've spent so much money on this thing, we've got to see it through to the end.
You can't abandon your those ideas if you think it makes up you as a person, right? And and I think increasingly people are defining themselves. You see it with a lot of people that are hardened, especially in America, not just Trump, but supporting particular political candidates. Whereas they don't say I'm a Republican, they say I'm pro-Trump, I'm a Trump supporter. They're aligning themselves with a person and a particular entity, as opposed to just an idea. And so then it's really difficult to abandon that, because you feel like you've been personally aggrieved if it turns out to be false.
That's a really good point. I mean, Trump's been proven to have said at least 20,000, is it? It's over 20,000, isn't it? Lies or misleading statements.
Really?
Wow. Just since he became president.
He tweets a lot. That boy tweets a lot.
He does indeed.
He really does. I mean, the other thing, going back to one of your early points, Robin, you said about 55% of people get their news from social media. You've got to think about all the other people that don't necessarily get their news but are influenced by their friends and family who have got their news on social media, right? And so if someone reads that misleading headline, the knock-on effect of that is that if they then post about it on their feed or do whatever or speak to them in a conversation, you know, it's not just what people are seeing on social media but the impact that has on those around them, because as we know, the biggest influence on voting behavior tends to be your friends, your family, and your social standing. So it does have that knock-on effect for sure.
And that's the thing as well with social media. It like puts people into echo chambers. So my social media feed is going to look very different to a member of my family's who supports the Tories. It's going to look totally and completely different. And I think it's part of the reason why we feel like everything's more divided these days, because I think people weren't necessarily passionate about either party necessarily, or quite a few people were just kind of like, whatever. But because of the way that we've been put into these like echo chambers, it's kind of galvanized people into these two separate tribes. Just based on what they're seeing, I think each one kind of reinforces the other. So if you're in that echo chamber of seeing all this Tory disinformation about the Labour Party, then you might not believe each one, but each one time you see it, it's just going to solidify your view even more. So they may not be getting more voters this way or converting more people, but they're definitely going to be solidifying the ones they have.
Yeah. In fact, the echo chamber concept ties in very neatly to one of the major techniques that's newly been developed and was used and employed by the Tory party in Britain in the 2019 election, which is something called micro-targeting. I don't know if you've heard of this.
Yes.
Yeah. It's basically what you just said, Alex. It's recognizing that echo chambers exist on social media, but it's going even further and targeting certain demographics. And I'm pretty sure Dominic Cummings is a big champion of this, and he's the chief advisor to our Prime Minister Boris Johnson and kind of the man credited with the success of the Brexit campaign back in 2016. And I'm pretty sure I watched a talk with him that's on YouTube where he more or less talks about this technique and says this is a way that you can use this to win elections, and so I'm pretty sure he uses it. And it's just a way, it's one of the five key strategies employed by social media disinformation campaigns, and micro-targeting is the latest one, and it's basically slicing up your electorate into small groups based on the demographics, their interests, their affiliations, political and social, and then creating tailored disinformation messages for each of those groups and exploiting that echo chamber effect to make sure that those groups are sharing that information amongst themselves and reinforcing that disinformation within their group. And I guess it takes advantage of it's a bit of a fallacy, but it's that sense that what do they call it, like the uniform voter effect, like all black people vote this way, all Catholics vote this way. And it's more nuanced than that, but micro-targeting is able to kind of subdivide within those groups and say, like, Catholics tend to vote Republican, but not all Catholics vote Republican. So what we'll do is we'll target the Catholics who we know are more inclined to vote Democrat, and we'll target them with disinformation that discourages them from voting for the Democrats in this election, which means that even if they don't vote Republican, they're not voting for the Democrats, and that's what counts.
Yes.
And like Alex said, taking advantage of the ones who do vote Republican and really guaranteeing that they will vote Republican.
I mean, in that scenario,
so sinister, isn't it?
In that scenario, it doesn't even have to be widespread disinformation. It just has to be selective, very, very selective to that particular group. It could be that what they're saying is kind of partially true, but actually they're missing out the other side of the story. So they could say, okay, if you were targeting... as you say a group of Catholics who would usually vote Democrat, you don't have to say what the Republican approach is that they might disagree with. All you have to say is, actually, this is what the Democrats, well, this is the thing that you disagree with from this side. And that's all that counts. It's all that matters.
Well, it's actually, coincidentally, a very, very apt example, because what was the number one most shared fake news story during the 2016 election? It was
about the Pope
that Donald Trump was, the Pope endorses Donald Trump as president, which obviously he didn't. But that was shared millions of times. So,
yeah, it's crazy. And that's the kind of clickbait, an example of the kind of clickbait that is also employed. It's listed here in this article from Forbes magazine amongst the five chief tactics or strategies used by disinformers on social media. I feel like clickbait was just a marketing tool, really, wasn't it? That's how it started. It's just a way to get people to read, click on your links and your articles. And it's about coming up with a snappy, controversial headline. But I guess the reason clickbait is useful is because that headline is often all that people see.
So, that's the thing. Is it even clickbait now? Because are they even trying to get people to click on anything, or are they just wanting people to read the headline?
No, you just see the headline and share it. You might not even share it. You just recycle that headline and informs your own views.
In this case, it doesn't even have to be any action. The thing of passively viewing it is enough, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I think more importantly, perhaps the world of clickbait in a non-political sense has created the environment where political clickbait can exist, because people are so used to seeing big, controversial, divisive headlines about anything, whether it's about Kim Kardashian's latest wardrobe malfunction or it's about the Queen tripping on her own dress. I don't know, who cares? That's two wardrobe malfunctions, just realised, never mind.
Wardrobe malfunctions.
it's all that whipping tongue. It's just completely. It's just on my head. I wonder if clickbait is a useful tool for disinformers, because regular clickbait, where it's literally just about enticing people to click on your article through a controversial headline, has created an environment where you can put out controversial falsehoods in a political context during an election, and people won't bat an eyelid at it. They'll just see it and be like, "Oh yeah."
In fact, sometimes it's better if they don't click, right?
Yeah.
You want them to have the headline. You don't want them to read into it or research, because then you'll uncover the actual truth. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Attention span dipping is helping disinformation for sure.
Yeah. And I mean, that all ties into another technique that's used, which is gaslighting, which is a phrase that's, I think, become particularly common in recent times. I think a lot of people on social media are familiar with the term gaslighting, which is psychological manipulation. It's probably the most significant one, I think, because it's employed outside the social media sphere as well. And in fact, I think Donald Trump uses this a lot, which is basically trying to change the terms of the discussion, the debate. It's about convincing people that something is real that simply isn't. It's as simple as that. It's a really primitive tactic, but it's very clever, and it's about just distorting people's sense of reality, and again exploiting echo chambers and exploiting social media in the way that people don't really read articles, they see the headlines, and just as well as using false data. And again, like climate change is a good example of gaslighting, or even Holocaust denial is another example, where if you get enough so-called experts who are either paid or who are themselves just liars, spreading the wrong truth, you get to redefine what truth is. And gaslighting in particular, I think, and this is where Donald Trump is particularly good at gaslighting, is about constantly questioning what is true and what is demonstrably true, isn't it?
Yes. That's it. Yeah, nail on the head there. Yeah, it's it seems to be a more prevalent tactic, doesn't it? Yeah, people.
Yeah,
yeah. Misremembering as well. There's a lot of in terms of historically something that happened, and just redefining the boundaries of what actually happened.
And it takes its name from a play called Gaslight, which was written in the early 20th century, I think. So it's nothing new. And in a way, politics has always used gaslighting, hasn't it? It's always been he said, she said. My opponent says this, but actually it's this. So that's just And I think that's probably why it's so insidious, why disinformation campaigns on social media can be so successful. It's because people have low expectations.
Yes.
When it comes to political campaigns, don't they?
I was going to say the core phrase that's so often used by, especially in the UK, whenever they go on a talk show to redefine the parameters of a discussion, is saying, "Let us be clear," and then saying something obscured. These precursors, and then say whatever they want to say. To make you think that what they're responding to is actually a clear and precise answer, when actually it's waffle and bullshit.
Yeah.
And look at what Trump has been saying about Biden the last couple of weeks. He's a communist owned and operated by Bernie Sanders and the radical left extremists. It's like, what are you on about? He's the most vanilla candidate. He's the most center ground, boring, milk toast. Like the last thing anyone could say about Biden is he's extremist.
That's a great example. That is a great example of gaslighting, because actually Trump has this wonderful habit of projecting onto his opponents. He nearly always accuses other people of doing exactly what he actually does. So in this case, there's more compelling evidence to say that Trump is the communist, in terms of Russia, owned candidate. Trump is the one who's susceptible to foreign influence. Trump is the one who's working for private interests against the interests of the public. And Trump is very good at projecting criticisms laid against him towards other people. And it's shockingly successful, I think. I think Boris Johnson over here, our prime minister, does the same thing. It's about owning the criticisms of you and throwing them back in the face of your opponents. And the regular discourse of debates don't allow for, there is no technique yet for responding to someone saying, I know you are, but what am I?
Yeah, what about us?
Yeah.
There's tons of what aboutism. Yeah, they go, something's leveled at them and they go, forget about that. What about them? And it's a tactic that's been used for decades and decades. But it just seems to have gone that extra level, especially with social media and the fact that everyone's in their own bubble. And the fact that people, as we said earlier, people don't seem to care about lying at all.
So is there any way that we can beat this and stop it from happening again, or can we stop it from interfering in the 2020 election? I'm not saying that we can stop it personally.
Us three. How can we personally stop this? Yeah.
But is there anything that en masse people can do to avoid disinformation or call it out when we see it?
I mean, we've talked about this before on the podcast, both on our Patreon exclusive podcast and I think on the main podcast, where at the moment social media firms are making efforts to remove fake news. I don't know if that's effective. I don't know if that's the way to go. But that's something.
I mean, there are different stages, aren't they, of doing it, both in terms of logistically, it's a difficult thing to do, but in terms of how willing they are. As we've seen with Facebook specifically, there was a lot of resistance to removing anything from the platform, because of course it's a pricey thing to do when you have billions of people on the platform. So that's one thing. I guess as individuals, we have to be more vigilant to false information. We have to stop sharing stuff that's literally just the headline, and fact check. That's it. The time and the resources.
It's pretty dire, isn't it?
we're in a bit of a state right now, and it seems like if the opposition party's doing it, to some extent you're going to have to do the same just in order to keep up, right? And that there's this almost a race to the bottom in terms of disinformation at the moment.
I mean, that's interesting. Like it seems like at the moment it's like one party's taking the low road, the other one's taking the high road, but when the people taking the low road always consistently win. Do you need to change your tactic and get down in the mud with them?
You'd hope not, because you'd think that over time, as we mentioned at the beginning of the pod, or the beginning of this particular section, that that it does have consequences, right? You'd hope that during the pandemic, if people start to realise actually they've been lied to, the knock-on consequences to that are significant. So you think that hopefully if people wake up and understand what's going on, that they'll have some kind of semblance going forward of the, you know, what's happening, and that basically they're being lied to. But until that happens, yeah, we really are in a tough spot. We really are.
I think ultimately it's about answering the question, who watches the Watchmen? Mm-hmm. And you mentioned already that this whole conversation was pretty much sparked by academic research and an advertising monitoring agency looking at elections and saying, they spread all this false information, here's a statistic to prove it. And that's good, that's a start. But the problem with those agencies is that even if they're independent, they're producing this information well after the fact and after the damage has been done.
Yeah.
So what we need is something more powerful. We need the politicians, sadly, to pass laws that make it illegal for them to do this, essentially. And that's sadly not, I don't think that's something that's going to happen anytime soon. So in the meantime, we as voters need to pay close attention to not only fact-checking any headline or article that we read, but paying particular attention in social media terms to where we're seeing this information coming from. Because there are two more techniques that I didn't mention, which form the kind of the five pillars of disinformation campaigns on social media, and they are the sock puppet and astroturf techniques. And they are kind of what you'd expect, which is, we've all heard of Russian bots and Russian spies pretending to be Western people, commenting and spreading articles and the memes that contain disinformation. That's essentially what sock puppeting is. It's false accounts, people perhaps controlling multiple accounts, people perhaps being fake accounts, pointing out other fake accounts. Mm. You know, this kind of incepted level of fake accounts.
It's like
going
information
on.
Information warfare.
Yeah, and astroturfing is a kind of extension of that, where what you have is you have big firms such as Cambridge Analytica, which became famous because of its involvement in abuse of Facebook data in, I think, in America and over here. And those kind of big firms that are paid for by political parties, and what they do is they hire loads of people to pretend to be ordinary people. They create loads of fake accounts or real accounts, but they're paying these people to pretend to be what they call grassroots. And this is where the AstroTurf thing comes from. Grassroots campaigners who seem like ordinary people on social media, who've got a genuine political argument to be made, but actually what they're doing is just towing the big party line and spreading disinformation on behalf of big political campaigners. And I think, personally, the only thing I can imagine that's worth doing is, until the government's passed laws that regulate themselves, we as voters need to, A, really be thorough about checking what information we're absorbing and what information we're choosing to believe, and B, as best as we can, persuasively arguing people away from disinformed positions.
Yeah.
And it's not just about saying, you're wrong, that's not true. It's about somehow convincing them in a friendly, reasonable way that they have been misled. Mm-hmm. And that's a tough challenge.
Back to the point of astroturfing and sock puppeting. Wasn't there a case where people were pretending to be the opposition and then saying something controversial and a bit stupid?
Mm.
And then responding to that from another account that they run, and trying to kind of build up the ante against the original comment. There was quite a few examples of that happening during the 2016 election.
I think it's like a technique that bots use, isn't it? Where they have someone, yeah, exactly. It's a way of like
they create their
ridiculing
own target.
The opposition, yeah, by like setting up these epic burns, but none of it's real. Person who's the opposition isn't really true. And another one is to have one of them make an outlandish claim or something that's not true, but then have another person reply backing it up and saying, oh, you're so right, you know. They're both bots and they're both the same person. What makes me laugh is when people are genuinely real, but they put in their like bios or descriptions, I'm not a bot, okay? Imagine, just imagine, you have views so or your social media personality is so intrinsically linked to like politics and your political opinion, that you often get accused of being a disinformation bot funded by a foreign actor.
Yeah, you think you might want to change your ways a little bit. You might be doing something slightly wrong. Yeah, if you're being accused of being a bot constantly.
Yeah, but I mean that's also easily exploitable. If people genuinely think that by just saying "I'm not a bot" works, then all the bots have to do is also say "I'm not a bot."
Not a bot.
Exactly. It's very true.
Yeah.
It's very true. So it seems like we're in a pretty tough spot going forwards, and partly due to social media, and partly due to the fact that no one cares about using these techniques and scrupulously. So yeah. It's a bit crap at the moment, isn't it, in terms of voting and elections?
Yeah.
I mean, it's not too many steps away from voter fraud, really, is it? Misinformation and disinformation.
No,
because you're lying to fix the result.
And I think perhaps for me, what really bothers me is that at its heart, it's nothing new. There's a stereotype for politicians lie, and we have this word propaganda, which sometimes is used to justify falsehoods. You know, most people don't have a problem with wartime propaganda. I mean, like Second World War, people look at the propaganda and think, oh, that's quaint, and oh yes, it was necessary to keep up the national morale. And you're just like, it's still just lying to people.
Yeah.
It's brainwashing. It's nothing new. And that bothers me. But I think what bothers me more is that people use that excuse to say, shrug it off, you know, just like, oh, well, what politicians do, it's propaganda, it's just what we've always lived with. And this weird implication that I guess it's optimistic, but it's kind of saying, oh, there's nothing new under the sun, so it's nothing to worry about, because humans, either that means humans are immune to it, or it doesn't matter because humans are always lying to each other, so a perfect world is unattainable.
I don't know. Yeah, it's true. Tends to only really be an issue, and only tend to be what humans have always done if it's supporting your own cause as well, right? Your own political beliefs.
Mm.
That's the other side of it.
Yeah, that's where my inner cynic, and I'm sure the two of you agree, always comes out, which is if there's a system that is flawed or corrupt, as long as it works for the people in power, it'll never change.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I think even when the opposition win, they're not going to change the system or put them in power. You know?
Yeah. That's why proportional representation is never, ever, ever going to be a thing in the UK.
No.
With that depressing and quite frankly horrible topic coming to an end, are you guys up for a bit more of a jolly quiz?
Yeah.
Oh, please make it jolly. Yeah.
Cool.
Definitely up for that now.
Please do. Yeah.
So this week's quiz is general knowledge, as usual. 10 questions plus a bonus question if we're tied. Gentlemen, can I hear your buzzers, please? Alex?
Yep. Well, I think you know what I've already gone for.
I've got a good guess.
Ah, the French champagne has always been celebrated for its excellence. There's a California champagne.
Oh, sorry, I went on for a little bit too long there. I got
no, you can never have too much of that.
Always love hearing it.
Oh, the French.
Always love hearing it.
Oh, so good. This is a California champagne. I've gone for an old favourite.
And Robin, yes.
Actually.
Yes.
It's been a while since I used this, I think, but...
The Wilhelm Scream.
Yeah. Ah,
it has been a while, hasn't it? It's been at least a couple of months.
I can't remember last time I used it. But yes.
That's an actual, you know, an old favourite of yours, wasn't it? The Wilhelm Scream. That's
a good one, yeah.
So the first three questions have a particular theme, and that theme is flags. So question number one.
Ooh, okay.
From left to right, what colours make up the Irish flag?
Left to right.
The French champagne.
Alex or Orson? Action Orson.
Is it orange, white, green?
It is not.
Is it?
No.
Is it green, white, orange?
It is green,
oh, goodness
white, orange.
Sake, no.
Right.
In fairness, I was going to say that anyway. But yeah.
What about if you're looking in a mirror?
Whoa. What if they look at it upside down?
Whoa.
Whoa.
Well, it should still be the same, actually.
It's crazy,
it?
Man.
Don't know how that works.
No, it wouldn't, would it? No, it wouldn't. If you're upside down, it'd be the other way, wouldn't it?
Yes, I guess.
Yeah. Yes, yes.
Question number two. From left to right, what colours make up the Belgian flag?
The French champagne.
Alex, you got there first again.
I've actually, what I've done here, Martin, is I've confused the Belgian flag with the German flag.
I see.
Oh, I don't know. Black, orange, red.
No.
Or yellow, red. Oh.
So is Alex still wrong, even if he says yellow?
I mean, that is right, yes. It's, yeah, you know, two bites. I'll give it to you. Why not? Black, yellow, black, yellow, red.
Yeah. Oh, nice. Okay. Sorry, I quickly corrected. I said orange in haste.
I think you meant yellow. That's fine. We'll give you that one.
Yeah, that's fair.
Okay. Question number three, and the final flag question. From left to right, what colours make up the French flag?
The French.
That was a Robin.
Now, I confess, I was more concentrated on trying to get my buzzer through first this time. actually.
Okay.
Trying to play my game.
Yeah, but now well, it's 50-50, I guess. Is it blue, white, red?
It's blue, white, red.
Yes.
There we go. So 2-1 to Robin. You'll be pleased to know that the flag questions are now over.
Oh.
Question number four. Who is the owner of the search engine Bing?
The French champagne.
That was Alex,
was
I believe.
Indeed.
I'm assuming you're after a company here. It's Microsoft?
Mm-hmm. It's Microsoft.
Yep.
Yes. It's Microsoft.
Oh.
Very good. Very good. Okay. Question number five to all. What is the most expensive movie ever made? I'm going from Wikipedia.
Has always been celebrated for its sex.
So no arguments. Alex, I think, just got there first.
I don't know why I thought this. I could be totally wrong. Is it Pirates of the Caribbean, Curse of Black Pearl?
It is not.
Oh. Is it Pirates of the Caribbean at World's End?
It is not.
Oh.
No.
In that case...
Celebrated for its excellence.
Yes, Alex.
Is it Pirates of the Caribbean, Dead Man's Chest?
It is not.
Oh, okay.
Alex.
If it's not Pirates of the Caribbean.
Yeah, it depends, because you said it's why what Wikipedia says, and Wikipedia is an interesting one. I would assume it's something like Avengers Endgame.
That's not what I've got.
Oh, okay.
No.
Can we have a clue?
Hmm.
It's from the Pirates of the Caribbean franchise.
Oh, right.
French champagne.
I mean, it's 50-50 now, isn't it?
Oh, yes.
I haven't seen the most recent one. Is it Pirates of the Caribbean on Stranger Tides?
It is. It's Pirates of the Caribbean on Stranger Tides.
That's not right.
Yeah. It doesn't matter if it's not right. It's from Wikipedia, Robin. It's what I've got down, so that's what matters.
So how much did it cost?
$375 million, I believe.
Wow.
That's not true.
What was your actual answer, Robin?
Well, Pirates of the Caribbean on Stranger Tides cost $258 million after tax breaks. They're probably including the marketing budget in that $375 million figure.
I'm going $378.5 million net from Forbes.
No. You don't have to justify this, Martin. Take the point off.
And if they got a rebate, tax rebate of $32.1 million, whereas the existing budget was $410.6 million.
Wow. Those are the stats I've got. That's crazy. But I don't believe that.
Go on, what would your answer be? You're not getting the point, but what was your answer?
Well, for the most expensive movie.
Take a point off.
Yeah.
Well, I'd say, I said it, I'd go for something like Avengers Endgame. But it's all
up
there.
No, that's wrong.
It's all in the wind. It's all in the wind because you never know. That's a crazy amount of money to spend on a film like that.
Apparently, it was $356 million.
Yeah, there you go.
That's less, isn't it?
Yeah, but
that's the second guitarist. I mean, these. I mean, with all of them, they're estimated budgets. That's the thing.
That's the problem.
It?
Yeah,
like you never know exactly how much. Plus, you never know exactly what the breakdown is between filming costs and marketing. And, you know,
well, that's what I mean. Like, if I'd say a budget is what they made the movie with, not what they marketed the movie with. Because because there's also like Avatar at the time was claimed to be the most expensive movie ever made, but the actual production budget for the film was something like $237 million. But if you
something
included...
like $237 million, sorry, that's going by... you can't say something like that. You knew that exact budget, okay, with, like that's... Google precision knowledge. Oh,
that's its official budget, but that's because, you know, people were claiming it was the most expensive movie ever made, and with some reason, because James Cameron had spent the previous 10 years spending $200 million on motion capture and 3D technology. So it's like to make that movie. So people are like, where does the budget start and end, you know, on a movie?
Exactly.
Like that?
Well, on the list I've got, the budget, you know, the buck stops with Pirates of the Caribbean on Stranger Tides. So, so that's the answer.
Well, all I can say is that movie looks like every penny went on screen.
Well, how comes those movies are so expensive? Because I knew that, like, they have been on the top, like the top of those lists before. I've seen it before, but why are they so expensive? Is it like, I guess it's all the props
and
the
actors as well.
Yeah, like Johnny Depp got like 80 million dollars for that movie, didn't he? So
that's gonna be a lot of it.
Yeah,
that's gonna be a lot of it. But well done, Alex, for being 100% correct.
Thank you, Martin. Rob, you're just bitter that I got a film question right.
Yes, I get that's it. That's the truth. I'm just bitter about that.
3-2. Question number 6. Who won the UEFA Champions League this week?
Oh, for goodness.
This week? There was a UEFA Champions League?
Champions League, the final.
I didn't even know that was a thing. Excellence.
Yeah.
This week.
There's a California.
This week. California champion.
Is it... Was it Chelsea?
No, it was not Chelsea. Yes, Robert.
Was it Liverpool?
It wasn't Liverpool. No. It was not an English team.
Oh, okay.
Celebrated for its sex.
Yes, Robert.
Real Madrid?
No. Not.
There is a California.
Was it Bayern Munich?
Oh, that was my next.
Is that a team?
Yeah, yeah.
It was Bayern Munich.
No!
They won the UEFA Champions League this week.
I'm so happy.
Well done. Well done. Very good. Very good. Very good. The German champions.
I got a film question and a football question. Right. What's going on?
It's your night, Alex.
Madness. Yeah, they beat Paris Saint-Germain, the French team, in the final.
Well.
4-2. Question number 7.
Oh, I thought you were saying the football score then.
No, it was 1-0, I think. 1-0.
Oh, okay.
7. Who wrote the song Bridge Over Troubled Water? Yes.
Was it Paul Simon and Art Garfunkel?
It was.
Yeah.
It was. Yeah. I mean, technically it was just Paul Simon. I think he actually wrote the song
himself.
Oh,
really? Oh, okay.
But Garfunkel, of course, famously sang it, didn't he?
Yeah.
And then, of course, they had a massive falling out, and I think Paul Simon held it against him.
Oh, really?
That he'd basically given him the opportunity to sing that solo. But anyway, 4-3. Question number 8. What is the highest score you can get in a game of 10-pin bowling?
French champagne.
Alex.
Celebrated.
Have you go bowling?
300?
It is 300.
Oh, wow. Knowledge.
It is.
Thank you.
What do you think of 300, that movie? You guys fans? Stylistically?
I mean, I can see why people like it, yeah.
It's basically like a shot for shot exactly like of the graphic novel,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah.
So like...
Is it?
It's completely very faithful, Frank Miller's...
Yeah.
Frank Miller's graphic novel. So I don't know. I mean, it's... Yeah. I'd like it. I'd watch it.
Mm.
Have you seen it?
Yeah, I've seen it.
Yeah.
Seen
it lots.
I remember watching
lots
it a few
times.
Years back. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't think it was okay. Who is it? Gerard Butler, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
Gerard
Butler. Star making turn. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it's decent. Michael Fassbender's in it too, like one of his early roles.
Mm. I told you again, it's been about 15 years, but I've watched the one again. Okay, so that is 5-3. Question number 9.
Oh, Alex has got this.
Well, no, there's a chance. There's
you're
going to
bring it back, Robin.
I don't think so. Not on this.
Question 9. When was... This is closest wins, by the way. When was the first electronic cigarette created?
The first electronic cigarette.
That's a...
I'm going to guess 1950.
Ooh, darn. Okay. Good guess. I'm going to go with 1960.
The answer is 1963.
Yes!
Oh, wow.
Wow.
Oh, okay. Okay, fair enough.
By a man called Herbert A. Gilbert. He invented... Herbert Gilbert. He invented a non-tobacco cigarette where a nicotine solution was heated to produce steam.
Oh. There we go. That's quite clever.
Yeah. Which is pretty much... I think that's how they work now.
Yeah. I imagine it was just slightly less practical in
1960. Yeah, I imagine it was quite a big old thing. Yeah. So that's 5-4.
Do you think his middle name was Albert?
Oh.
Herbert Albert Gilbert.
Now it's
his
Herbert.
His friends call him Bert.
Herbert A. Gilbert. So should I just look that up quickly?
Yes, please. I want to know. Please say it's
if
Albert.
If it's not Albert,
I'm
that's
very disappointed if it's not Albert.
Herbert A. Gilbert.
I'm just going to... Yeah.
Ooh.
Oh.
The A. What does it stand for? Why does it
no
stand
one does.
For?
No.
It just keeps on saying A. Gilbert. Herbert Gilbert. I think we'll never know.
No.
Oh, no.
I'm not sure what we're going to find
out. Can't leave this unresolved. Maybe it was just A. Maybe that was his middle name, A.
It just says A everywhere, man. It doesn't even have his middle name. This is crazy.
That's so annoying. I need to know.
Oh, well. I'll try to look it up at the end and maybe add on to next week's. Okay, question number 10. Okay. 5-4.
Oh, God.
Which country is the most resource-rich in the world?
French champagne has always been celebrated.
Alex has buzzed. He now must answer.
Resource-rich. Is it...
Yes.
Is it China?
Is it China? It is not China.
Oh, no.
Robin.
Is it Russia?
We're going to a tiebreaker.
Oh no!
It's Russia.
It is Russia.
Of course $75 trillion in natural resources.
Wow. Russia's massive.
This isn't a bonus point, but can you guess what their biggest money maker, well, it's not money maker because they're not going to sell it, but their biggest resource is?
Uranium.
It's not uranium.
Oh.
Is it like Arctic oil that they can't harvest?
No, it's actually timber.
Oh,
28.4 trillion dollars worth of timber.
Wow.
Yeah, big old country, lots of woodland.
Yeah, I'm glad. I hope they're not chopping it all down. That'd be sad.
No, you'd hope not. Mm. You'd hope not. Okay, bonus question.
Oh.
5-all as well.
Comfortable.
Yeah, 5-all.
Perfect. Wow. Split, yeah.
Madness. Okay. Ready.
Sorry, too ready. Apparently, too ready. No, that was an accident.
Have a guess.
Three.
You've been around the block, Robin. You know how this quiz works.
I don't actually. This is always a wild card. The bonus question.
Bonus question is always closest wins. So, how many Nintendo Switch consoles have been sold to date?
To date.
Oh God. Mm. Oh no.
Well, here you go, Alex. You get a free one here because I'm going first.
At latest counting.
200 million.
Okay.
That's way too many, isn't it?
I think it's got to be less than that. 200 million, that's a lot, isn't it? Okay.
French champagne.
I'm going to not be a total dick, but a bit of a dick. And I'm going to go 150 million.
Alex, you're this week's winner.
No.
62 million.
Oh, okay. Nice.
200 million.
Okay, I kind of got carried away.
That's more than the PS2, I think, isn't it?
Probably.
Yeah.
I know. There's like 7 billion people in the world. Surely there's enough.
Yeah, I guess so, yeah. They are popular, though, aren't they? And it's only been out for a couple of years. Yeah. Yeah, well, 3 years, isn't it? Three and a half years.
And I know so many people who have like a PS4 or an Xbox and a Switch. So I feel like that's...
I think... Oh, what's it called? Animal Crossing definitely boosted their sales, didn't it, at the beginning of lockdown. Everyone was mad for it.
I mean, I got one during lockdown for that exact, Animal Crossing and a Switch. I'm one of those people.
You're 62 million people, yeah.
Yeah.
How is it? How do you find it compared, not Animal Crossing, but the Switch compared to your PlayStation or PC or whatever?
I mean, honestly, like, I've never been like a Nintendo fanboy, so all the games on it, like, they're not really the kind of games I'd normally go in for. Mm. So, like, I'm more of like Naughty Dog, Uncharted, kind of thing. Mm. So, and the thing is, like, with other like consoles and on PC, which I'm used to, you get like amazing deals. So, like, games can go on offer for like 90% off, and you can get some really good games that are a couple of years old for like pennies.
Yeah.
Whereas on the Switch, they just never go down in price.
So yeah, they retain their value well.
So, like, games that are, like, 5 years old are still 40, 50 quid. So it's just so expensive to actually have one.
Yeah, they've got a tight grip on the pricing, haven't they?
Yeah, Nintendo have always been really good at that. I mean, I think Nintendo games, GameCube games are worth more than when I first bought them.
I mean, it's kind of annoying, actually. Like, there are games on there that have been ported over to Switch, like Skyrim, which came out in 2011. And it's still on the Switch for like 40 quid. It's like, I've bought it so many times already. I'd probably rebuy it if it was like a fiver or a tenner.
Yeah.
Yeah, especially a really old game. Anyway, thank you very much. Well done, Alex.
Yeah, great quiz, Martin.
Your wonderful victory.
Really good. That's definitely a measure of success if every question was successfully answered. That's a good quiz. Sign up for your quiz.
I mean, it could suggest that it's too easy, but.
No.
I think with the first few, there was an opportunity to get it wrong and then get it right with the flags.
Yeah, oh yeah, that was good. Yeah, yeah, good questions.
My quick last minute correction with the Belgium flag definitely saved me.
Yeah, that did help, actually. The Champions League question, I thought you did very well there, Alex, to get that from the back of your mind.
Thanks. Don't know where it came from. It was in there somewhere.
It was somewhere. My next guess, Bayern Munich. I was like, Real Madrid, Bayern Munich are the only European teams I know. I'll start with Real Madrid. Just annoyed at myself.
Was Bayern Munich a real team or one that I've just combined some words together?
Yeah. Is it something from like the Mitchell Webb look when they're going through football teams?
Yeah, good quiz. Well done. That makes Alex the victor again, which puts him definitely top of the league table.
He's doing well.
Am I in the lead at the moment?
Yeah, I am.
You are doing very well.
Well, are you like three out of five now, maybe?
Yeah, man. At least.
I think it's actually, it might be three out of four, you know.
Yeah.
Oh.
You're doing very well. Oh. 75%. That's an A.
That's amazing.
That's an A.
That is an A. Yeah. Or, you know, in current standards, that's about a C. If you're following with the...
You've been downgraded.
The grades fiasco. little joke there.
Nice. That was a mess. That was an absolute mess. For anyone in the US, we apologise. We probably don't know what that's about.
That was an hour. But anyway, quiz, wasn't it? So.
It was, actually, yeah. So if you're not sure about that, go back and watch the last bit. But yeah, thank you, everyone, for listening, watching, wherever you are. Hope you enjoyed the main topic about disinformation. Let us know your thoughts in the comments below. Be sure to leave a review if you fancy doing so, and check us out on our Patreon too, where we are discussing this week Kim Jong-un dying for about the eighth time. I think with that all said and done, take care, guys, have a great week, and we'll see you next time.
See you next time.
See you later.
Bye.
Bye.